woke up and wished that I was dead, with an aching in my head. I lay motionless in bed. I thought of you and where you'd gone. Let the world spin madly on. And everything.
Good morning, and
I'm on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Sorry, I'm out of practice.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. Listening to some music from the Weepies this morning, who will be performing at Mass Mocha tomorrow night. And you can find out more information by going to massmocha.org. We're going to be playing their music throughout our panel segment this morning, in and out of breaks. So that's fun. What was the line? I woke up and I wish I were dead. Was that the line? Yeah. That was the beginning line?
Well, with really soft acoustic guitar, and then suddenly they come out and woke up, wish I was dead.
Well, kind of set the tone, doesn't it? Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome. It's Friday. It's the 3rd of November. Happy Friday to you all. It's a delight that you have decided to spend at least part of your day with us. I appreciate it very much. Let me introduce our panel, and then we'll get into the discussions for the day. I don't know. I guess I'll probably be saying this till for a long time. But we have a lot to discuss today. It seems that we have not been, for the last year and a half, stretching for material. So here we go. Let me first and foremost welcome back our good friend Rich Honan, who's here, hasn't been with us for a little while. We're thrilled. People keep on thinking that we've thrown you off the air. I hope you will tell them that we beg you and you come when you can.
Yeah,
right?
The invitations are there, and it's on me when I'm not here.
All right. Good to have you back. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Aaron Pasitti joins us as well. He is an economics professor at Siena College, and he is a regular here on Friday mornings, and we're thrilled that you're here. Thank you very much.
And I'm happy to be alive.
Well, and we're happy you're alive, too.
But you really are the man of the hour when you think about the tax bill. And
that's a lot of pressure.
You got to explain this all to us, because I know it makes perfect sense.
Something like that.
Yeah.
If you're rich.
Rich or rich.
It's already starting.
Yes. Judith Eng joins us. She is a former regional administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency, and she is also a regular panelist on this program. We are thrilled to have her. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
Good morning, and Rich, nice to meet you for the first time.
Nice to meet you.
Oh, all is right. That right? Ooh.
Yeah.
This is a potential match.
We were talking clean energy off air.
Ooh.
It'll be fine. Yeah.
It's okay that people disagree.
No, we're supposed to disagree.
All I said was it was nice to meet you, and I meant that genuinely.
What do you mean by that? Mm.
And Alan Chartok is with us. Nice to meet you, Alan.
And nice to meet you, my old partner here. It's wonderful to be here.
All right. Well, we are ready to go, so let's do it. And we'll start with the tax plan and try to make some sense of it, I guess. The GOP tax plan would shrink mortgage interest benefits, slash the corporate tax rate. The question is, will the math work? And there are some members of the House Republicans who are abandoning this over those items that I just mentioned, as well as other items as well. It's the biggest overhaul of the U.S. tax code in three decades. Reading from the Washington Post, a plan that would sharply cut tax rates for corporations and individuals while eliminating many popular deductions that Americans have long enjoyed. At its core, the legislation would deliver the kind of tax relief to companies, $1 trillion over 10 years, that Republicans say will spark economic growth and encourage businesses to create more jobs and invest heavily in the United States. Far less clear is the bill's impact on middle and working class households. The trade-off between reducing tax rates but curtailing deductions, such as the amount that homeowners can write off for their mortgage interest payments, means the impact will vary widely from one family to another. There was an excellent report, I'll give kudos to NBC last night, that did a report on five different families across the country and how it would affect them differently in their towns. And I thought it was a very good illustration of just how widely it impacts. Aaron, what do you make of this? We talked about this last week. I'll put you on the spot again this week.
So I think this is a great plan. I really think this is going to do a lot for economic growth. That was a. I'm sorry. That was just a
joke.
Moment of delusion. I'm sorry. Back to reality. So yeah, the so it's a $1.5 trillion tax plan. A trillion of it is going to businesses in the form of lower corporate taxes.
You were just showing off for rich.
Yeah. No. I had a change of heart last night. So yeah, there's a huge tax cut. The corporate tax rate is slated to go down from 35% to 20%. There's three new tax brackets, a 12%, a 25%, a 35%, and then the top tax bracket of 39.6% will stay for millionaires.
May I interject something real quick? So sure. There used to be seven tax brackets.
Correct.
There are now three. Were you a fan of seven?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people complain that the tax code is unnecessarily complex.
Unwieldy.
But that has nothing – I mean – that really comes when you're itemizing deductions and looking for loopholes and, you know, preferential treatment. For the average middle-class taxpayer, it's not fun to do taxes, but it takes, you know, an hour or two every April to do. So just reducing the number
you're
of
kidding.
Tax brackets is not simplifying.
Well, he's an economics professor.
Your situation may vary. And by the way, thank you for thinking that we do our own taxes.
Okay. Yes. So
but you know, I'm sorry for interrupting, but there was, you just said, Joe, and you say, Aaron, that there are three brackets. Actually, some newspapers have been reporting four, and some have been reporting three.
Well, there's three plus the highest.
Three,
yeah,
four.
Yeah, right. There's
well, that,
three plus
we call
the
where
highest.
I come from,
we call
four.
It three plus one. Yeah, we'll call that one. Yeah.
And there's actually a fifth tax bracket that's a 0% tax bracket where people yeah. earning less than $24,000 a year will have no tax liability.
Yeah.
And I see that as a good thing. That's one of the positive parts about the tax plan. But then when you start looking at the details and looking in the middle, people who are earning or married households filing jointly who are earning around $100,000. So that's two people earning $50,000. So, you know, middle class jobs
right.
will actually see a tax increase. Under this plan, because the those middle tax brackets go up relative to where they were before. But like I've said before, the average middle class family is going to see about a 1% increase in their after tax income. And the top 1%, the millionaires, even though their tax bracket is not changing, are going to see an after tax increase in their income of 20%. So it's a tax plan that is heavily tilted towards the wealthy. So a lot of people might wonder, well, if the tax bracket on the richest Americans doesn't change, how are they going to get 20% more income? And the answer comes in all of those changes to the estate tax. So now instead of taxing estates that are earning more than, I think it's like $5.5 million, that's going to be raised to $11 million. So
sure.
for a lot of the super, super rich, that's going to save them millions in taxes.
So maybe I misheard you, but what you're telling us is that the rich are going to make out here.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, more than anybody else. And right. it's not from
the
necessarily
rich, the rich
higher...
and their families. The
Correct.
Estate tax thing is pretty
and then
big.
And their heirs.
And then there's another killer in this thing, because every time we middle class people go to our tax filer, unlike, you know, brains like you.
Actually, my wife does our taxes.
Well, okay.
So I don't
or
do
like
them,
her.
So thanks, Allison.
We get told you did
pretty
well.
In addition to being a concert violinist. Yeah. And
you did pretty well, except... there's something called the alternative minimum tax.
Yeah, I was going to get
okay,
to that.
Please then, go ahead.
So the alternative minimum tax is essentially a safeguard against people earning more than $200,000 to make sure they don't just deduct everything and end up paying no taxes.
Right.
So it's a way to essentially ensure that upper middle class and, you know, very wealthy earners pay some fair share of taxes. And that's going to be eliminated, much like the estate tax, after 6 years. So you see the two main tools outside.
What do you mean after 6 years?
So the estate tax will disappear after 6 years.
I see.
That you can pass on as much as you want to your heirs without any tax consequences whatsoever. But
right.
if the plan is passed now, for the next 6 years, the threshold on that is going to rise from $5.5 to $11 million.
And this is very popular for the American people.
Sure.
Because, you know, when you theoretically say, I don't want anybody, I want to leave my money to my kids. I don't want anybody telling me I can't leave money to my kids, even though the exemption now is $5.5 million
right.
or whatever.
Who's leaving $5.5 million
so,
to their
yeah.
so,
and then it's going
children.
To go to $11 million under mm-hmm. this plan.
You're talking about the richest one tenth of 1% of the population.
Yeah.
And the Republicans have been passing this off as well. It's going to hurt family farms. I think there's 0.01% of family farms who would be subjected to this. So you're talking about you know, the smallest possible percentage of households that would be subject to this. Sure. It's not destroying and, you know, there's no economic gain with passing wealth on from one generation to another. John Rockefeller was the biggest proponent of a 100% inheritance tax because he thought that, one, passing on wealth to your children would make them lazy and destroy their motivation, and two, that the rich have a moral responsibility to be philanthropic and use their money, you know, to yeah. create things like the New York Public Library.
To which the Rockefeller children replied, "Mind your own business, Dad."
I was going to say that. Yeah, right. That means
that was
Nelson.
Also after he accumulated his fortune by stealing it from everybody else.
Right. That means Nelson had no money.
So there's no change to the capital gains tax rate. Businesses are going to be able to immediately expense investments instead of over a longer term. You know, the important thing to understand here is that even though the corporate tax rate is being lowered from 35 to 20%, and the argument is that that's going to make the U.S. tax system more competitive with international tax systems.
And more people will come back here, the theory.
Right. And then there's the 10% territorial tax, where no matter if you earn your profits abroad, you're going to have to pay 10% on that. So that's the sticker price. It's like going to a car dealership. If a car's $35,000, everybody knows you can negotiate that down. So the biggest corporations like Apple, Google, General Electric actually pay single-digit tax rates because they get exemptions and they find ways to skirt tax law. So they're, you know, Apple paid 2% last year and Google paid 2%. These are multi-billion dollar companies.
And you didn't mention General Electric.
They often pay zero.
IBM.
GE often pays zero taxes.
So, you know, the reduction in that's largely symbolic. In that we're going,
meaning they're already making out,
right? That's not going to have any material effect on now. If Trump were, if this tax plan were to actually close a lot of those corporate loopholes,
yeah,
then that would be a positive thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. So my bet is that this tax plan does not pass in its current form. And to the extent that it does pass, it's going to be wildly different than what came out yesterday.
Okay, so Aaron, this is very helpful, but. Considering everything you've just said, obviously the art of the deal and Trump and all the rest, they're putting things on the table that they can negotiate with. So what's on the table you see in this tax plan that
state and local?
That's right. Okay, so go start with state and local.
So people who live in high tax states where the state income tax is high, like Connecticut,
like New York,
Massachusetts, California, New Jersey, California.
Yeah.
That they will
they
be
all
limp.
Vote?
Yeah, they also happen to be blue states.
We'll call these the blue states. That's right.
So now I've
got the blues.
So now they're allowed to deduct the first $10,000 of their property taxes, but no more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's on the table. So you're going to see a lot of Republican opposition in the House from representatives from those states.
Okay, can you explain that for those of us who have limited intelligence? So you're saying up to $10,000. What does that mean?
So imagine you pay $50,000 in state taxes.
Yes.
So that's going to be state income tax, state sales tax, state property tax. That under the federal tax code today, you can deduct a large percentage of that from your federal tax liability.
Sure.
So if you can,
it reduces out of pocket. It essentially, if they do this, your taxes go up 25% to 40%.
Right. So what this is, so it's called the SALT, the state and local tax exemption. So that was supposed to just be, we're going to get rid of that. But the compromise was, well, now people, instead of deducting in this hypothetical example, $50,000, can only deduct $10,000. So that raises their tax liability by $40,000.
Wow.
So that's going to hit high tax states the hardest, and there's already Republican opposition from representatives in those states saying we can't live with that, our constituents won't live with it. So you're already starting to see Republican opposition to that. The other thing that's on the table is the mortgage interest tax deduction, where people could deduct the interest they pay on their mortgage from their tax liability, and the cap on that was $1 million. So you couldn't so people who
if your mortgage was up to $1 million for the first $1 million of your mortgage, you could deduct the interest off of it.
Right.
So that's been
lowered.
And there
are people like my wife who insist that we continue to have a mortgage, even though we might not have to.
To have the deduction?
To get the deduction. In order to have this deduction. And so if this happens, then we're going to go back to the drawing boards in the Chartock House.
Yeah. So that's being lowered from $1 million to $500,000, which I actually think is a very good plan. And I think that's one of the positives in this because, you know, people who are buying $1 million houses probably don't suffer from cash flow constraints. So lowering that I see as a good thing.
But the
National Association of Home Builders, yeah, right. The National Association of Realtors have all come out against this saying, nope, this is not going to fly. So you're starting to see this opposition. And that's normal for a first draft of a bill and that now the negotiations begin of where the give and take is going to occur.
Before we get into the negotiations and the politics of this, I read a really good summary this morning in the New York Times, Who Are the Winners and Who Are the Losers, an article by Alan Rappaport. The winners, and I'm curious if you all agree with this, businesses, multinational corporations, some middle-class families, the rich and their families, and hedge funds. The losers, real estate industry, the deficit, so the deficit hawks, the sick, charities, university endowments, rare disease sufferers, and electric car owners, because they're getting rid of the tax credit for electric cars.
And students, because this is proposed to eliminate the
student loan interest deduction. Yeah.
No, so in an era where students are paying, you know,
wait, is there a student loan interest deduction?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's being eliminated in the current plan.
And why charities? You got my attention, Judith.
Yeah, I don't know the details. I mean, yeah, there have been discussions about your tax deductibility of charitable gifts, but we've got to look into that more.
Yeah, sure.
All right, we have about a minute. Did you want to chime in, Rich, at all, about what you make of this?
No, I agree with all of Aaron's analysis. I think the state and local tax thing is just awful. I think the whole plan is awful.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So just to get it straight, we can deduct, according to this new bill, we can deduct our we can't deduct our state income taxes, for example. We can do our
property tax. Property tax.
Yeah. We let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have much more to discuss. We'll take your letters as well. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Rich Hone and Aaron Pasitti, Judith Hank and Alan Chartock, and we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Before we go to the letters, anybody have anything else they would like to add about the tax plan and what we think the future of this legislation is going to be over the next? We should say it's fast-tracked. Mm-hmm. They want this done. The president said mm-hmm. he wanted it done by Christmas. Paul Ryan says he wants it done by Thanksgiving. They don't want any grass growing. In other words, they don't want anyone really to read it. So,
and they don't want it to be bipartisan. I mean, the bill just came out yesterday. They're right. doing markup next week. They're fast-tracking it. I think it's important to note that no Democrat had any input into this. And that didn't exactly work out well for them on other things.
That has become the way, though, right?
Right.
And on both sides, really. Hasn't that become the way?
And it's not working.
Correct.
It's not in the public interest. So not one hearing. Everyone just got to see the bill yesterday. It's going to be marked up this week. My prediction is it'll pass the House, and they're going to have a really rough time in the Senate. They can only afford to lose two Republicans in the Senate, and Susan Collins has already raised concerns. The president seems to be developing a very close working relationship with Senator Corker and Senator Flake. Who knows where they're going to come down?
Flake has already come out against it in Senate floor last night.
Yeah. Really? That's interesting. So, you know, this rush to get it done by the end of the year is going to be pretty wild. And then the president wants a win at any cost. I doubt he's read the bill.
If you look at previous the Reagan tax cuts in the 80s, the Bush tax cuts in the early 2000s, I mean, those took a year plus to hammer out because tax reform is complicated.
Much harder than health care.
All these moving parts. And I hate to use the Arrested Development reference again, but this is when Job's like, we're going to build a house in 2 weeks, and then the house falls down. The one thing I did want to bring up is that the Congressional Budget Office has yet to score this. And once the plan becomes finalized, they will score it, and you'll get a much more accurate assessment of its impact on the possible benefits from cutting taxes on growth and employment and some of the negative aspects on the deficit. So remember, every policy has an opportunity cost. So we're, you know, right now the projection is $1.5 trillion. Well, that's almost enough to fix all of our infrastructure needs for the next 10 years. So
and by
airports,
the way,
bridges, schools, clean water.
And by the way, Aaron, who believes them about anything? So if they say $1.5 trillion, we know that $1.5 trillion is as far as they can go. And under the rules of, you know, not having a filibuster. And so what we're facing here is, do you believe them that it's only going to be $1.5 trillion?
This is why the Congressional Budget Office scoring matters a lot, because it's going to be a very, you know, they have their models. They did this for the Bush tax cuts. Mm-hmm. They did it for the Clinton tax increase. They did it for the Reagan tax cuts. It's an estimate. They're not always right, but it'll be a lot more accurate than, well, this is $1.5 trillion or so.
But the made up part of the number is the is actually the part that I champion. But it's a made up part of the number, which is what is the growth attributable to the tax cut?
Right.
You know, that's mm-hmm. just a number you pull out of the air. You know.
So, well, what do you think, Rich?
Well, this I think it's an awful plan. I think it's a misnomer to call it a tax. It's not a tax cut. It's, you know, it's a redistribution of wealth. It's just, mm-hmm. you know, when the Democrats did it, they redistributed it to, you know, the lower income. Now the Republicans are redistributing it to the higher income. But it's not a tax cut. The whole idea of a revenue neutral tax cut to me is an oxymoron. I don't want my tax cut to be revenue neutral. I'm willing to increase the deficit for a tax cut the same way I'd be willing to spend money on R&D. If I was running a corporation. Now, you guys may disagree. You may say cutting taxes does not lead to growth. But if I start with that as my assumption, if I'm a drug company, I'll spend $1 billion on R&D. And yes, I'll make $1 billion less that year.
Research and development.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm research and development. Yep. But I feel like I will someday get a return. So I'm willing to bust the deficit a little bit on this. This doesn't do anything. I think it actually increases taxes. Certainly, I didn't see anything there for me personally.
So what are the time bombs buried in this thing? So, for example, I would submit to you guys that AMT is a time bomb.
Absolutely.
That's going to mean a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah, AMT
in the upper
stinks.
Middle class. What'd you say?
The AMT stinks.
From your perspective, because you're rich.
You do your taxes, and you're like, all right. And then the accountant comes in and says, oh, now you have the AMT.
Yeah, but right.
Anyway.
There's a lot in here we don't know. For instance,
there's
they get rid of the tax credit for parents who adopt children. I don't know the social benefit of that.
Well, they would say, and I don't like the plan either, Judith, but I think what they would say for a lot of those things is we've increased the standard deduction, mm-hmm. and that's meant, right. and you know, right. by a lot, and that's meant to right. basically put people more in the non-itemized category and pick up all of these. I don't know whether that's true, but I think that would be their response, right?
Yeah. Same thing with the student loans.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of cruel in an era where, you know, college tuition is, you know, quadrupled in cost over the past four
60
decades.
60 grand to send a kid to college now?
Yeah, that's very common.
So, I mean, so there's an economic effect of that. So when students graduate with a high debt burden, the student loan interest tax deduction takes a little bit of the edge off of that. It's not making student, you know, recent graduates wealthy. But when, you know, you come out of college and you have this huge debt burden, you're probably not going to buy a home right away. A lot of your newfound income is going to go to servicing that debt instead of consumption, and that is a growth slowing measure. So, you know, you have something like that, which is going to pull down growth versus the estimated effects of, you know, businesses being to immediately able to deduct investment expenses, right, which could be a pro-growth phenomenon. And this is why the a more rigorous scoring and analysis of the plan is really necessary.
Yeah, I thought the five-year expensing was one of those things that you could say, okay, I could see how that could drive growth. So,
okay, explain that to us.
So, so right now, if you're a business, not everything a business spends is currently deductible, okay? And what this does is it takes some of those items and says, 100% of what you spend is going to be deductible over 5 years, okay, as opposed to, you know, amortizing something over 30 years or even having only half of it be deductible or something. So I could understand theoretically how you say, all right, so we're going to basically incent businesses to spend more money. That's good. That puts money out there and they buy things, they use vendors and things like that. That's one of the few things I think is actually a pro-growth part of it.
Yeah, and, you know, in an era where business investment has been slow since the end of the recession, I mean, you have this giant surplus of savings with just money sloshing around in financial markets that's not going to productive investment, it's going to speculative investment, that perhaps redirecting that towards business capital investment might be a good thing that could result in economic growth.
Yeah, I would challenge you a little bit on that. I agree with you. I would challenge you when you say capital spending has been slow. I think domestic capital spending has been slow.
Spending, right,
but
yes.
Domestic company, well, what I still consider Apple a U.S. company, even though they're not. But, you know, they're spending money in China, mm-hmm, and they're spending, you know, in Scotland and everywhere else. So, and I think that's part of what they're trying to do here is, mm-hmm, to draw some of that back here.
Yeah. Let's get to some letters before we go to a break. We have several, so let's go to those.
Okay. Panel, the tax plan reduces the SALT, state and local taxes, deduction. Isn't that double taxation on the money we pay to New York State? Isn't that exactly what the GOP complained about regarding taxing corporate profits twice, once by the corporation and once by dividend recipients? And that's from Elizabeth.
Yes. The answer is you are correct.
No.
You don't think that's double taxation?
No. I mean, you know, states provide services that the federal government doesn't, and the federal government provides services that the state doesn't. So you're just essentially paying two separate taxes. I don't see it as double taxation. I see it as two different forms of taxation.
But you do see it as punitive towards the blue states.
You used,
right,
to be able to deduct, as we stand here today, you're able to deduct your state taxes.
That's right.
And you won't be able to later.
Yeah.
And that's a big nut. In New York, that's 8%.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And if you're a New York state resident, right, and you're a New York City resident, right, that's huge. But although the city would be local taxes, right? I would think.
Yes. Yes. And local,
yeah,
taxes.
State, yes, and local. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Jennifer says, if the proposed tax plan, I heard that student loan interest paid will not be tax deductible. We've just talked about that. That's correct. Under the,
yeah, correct,
plan, right. Okay. Amber says, I went to state school and pay over $600 a month in student loans. Eliminating that tax deduction is a huge hit for me as a middle income earner. As a PhD economist, how does Dr. Pacetti feel about the new Fed chair not being a PhD economist?
Ooh, there's a lot wrapped up in that one. So yes, the student interest deduction is going to disappear, and that's going to have negative growth effects. I don't think that a Fed chair needs to have a PhD in economics. It helps. The Fed Board of Governors, of which the Fed chair is a part of, are surrounded by an army of PhD economists who provide very accurate, very unbiased research on the state of the economy.
But it is interesting, isn't it, that the president, who's under fire from so many different forces, but who has one thing going for him right now, I don't know if it's going to continue, which is the economy and the a number of jobs and all the rest, he didn't want to fool around with that. So what he did was to take, he did not want to appoint a Yellen, who was appointed by Democrats, to the job. So he put a Yellen lookalike.
Right.
Into the job, and the idea there was to have the benefit of it, but at the same time, not because he's crazy on this business of appointing Democrats.
Right. So the jobs report just came out at 8:30 this morning. The U.S. economy added 261,000 jobs. The unemployment rate dropped to 4.1%
from 4.2.
That's 4.2. Full employment.
Yeah, we're very close to full employment. There's wage gains that are lacking, but the point is that the Bernanke, Yellen approach of very low interest rates, a lot of stimulus coming in the form of increasing the Fed's balance sheet and putting more credit in circulation has worked. It's worked slowly because there's been very little help from fiscal policy and government spending or, you know, tax reform. So, yeah, he's looking for a Yellen clone who will have the same direction that, you know, Bernanke and Yellen had, but with a slightly softer touch towards some form of financial sector regulation.
And George, I think the anemic job gains would have happened without this, without the Fed intervention. I've always taken issue with that. I think that the job gains, if you want to call them that, that took place over the last 8 years, I think they're going to take place as a result of coming out of the recession without respect to the, you know, the stimulus or, you know, QE3 or 4 or quantitative, right? You know, I think that the Fed gets a lot of credit for that. I don't think it's deserved. And I think what you're seeing now, part of what you're seeing now, and I know everybody's going to jump on me, is some of the Trump effect from January, where you see big increases in hiring. I agree with you. There's still stagnant wages, and that is something, even though it's a trailing indicator, that's got to start coming up soon.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we have more letters. We'll get to those, and then we'll move on to other topics as well. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Again, play music by the Weepies. They're going to be performing at Mass Mocha tomorrow. And
Ventures-like, wasn't it?
What?
Kind of Ventures-like sound to that one.
I like it.
That's good. I like it.
I don't even know what I mean by saying this, but it seems like good music for a Friday.
Yeah. They came after the Weavers, these guys?
Yeah. Post-Weavers. The
Weepies. Post-Weavers, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I think that was their original name. The Weepies, post-Weavers. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We want to move on to other stuff, so let us get to that. Okay, do the letters quick, and then we'll move on.
Really quickly. Okay, George, question for Rich Honan. It's nice to hear Rich Honan back on the program. Voices like his are too few on the panel. The last time I heard him, some time ago, he was asked if he thought health care was a right or a privilege. He answered, privilege. I was appalled that no one on the panel challenged him. What do you mean, Rich? It would be instructive to hear his rationale for his position. Rich? And that's from George.
By the way, we got so many letters on that. I think everyone challenged you on that. I do not agree with the assertion that you were not challenged on that. But go ahead.
I actually would downgrade it from a privilege to a commodity that can be purchased.
That's a whole other show.
Okay. That's a whole other show. Okay. Bill says, our friend Bill. Hi, panel.
And
please.
You wonder why he's not on more often. Go ahead.
Brazil and Warren. Hi, panel. Please discuss the current statements by Donna Brazil and Elizabeth Warren regarding the DNC's rigging of the nomination process in favor of Hillary Clinton. Yours, Bill.
Did you guys must have hit that, right?
Yeah, we have. Okay. Let me
from the Bernie perspective. That's pretty interesting.
Let's just put it on hold, and then because I'd like to bring it up later. But okay. let's get the tax cut stuff, and then we'll move on.
Okay. Russ says, blue state blues. To stop the Republican blue state tax hike, the Democrats will have to remain united and add to the support of 20 or so Republican deficit hawks. If they cannot show early evidence of this unlikely alliance, they will face an up or down vote on the current package pushed through by the leadership. We should see where the cards are dealt in the near future.
Do we agree as a panel that if there's going to be big movement on anything, it's going to be on the state and local taxes?
Well, I think that's one of the ones that they put up there so they can negotiate.
So they can knock it down. Sure. Yeah. Or, Judith, you don't see that?
Yeah. I mean, I think the way it is now, it'll
so offensive.
It won't pass the Senate. It might actually pass the House. I think.
Which is an autocracy.
Right. I just.
Not but even when you have like Peter King and those people coming out against it, do you think?
They're going to round up enough Republican votes in the House that this House will vote for almost any dreadful policy that they can get a majority on. I mean, I think the focus is really in the Senate. I think SALT will change But they've got big math problems on this.
Yeah, they have big math problems.
Well, again, they're starting from a faulty. They're thinking they have to make it revenue neutral, and well, we had this conversation. I just think they're wrong, and they think they have to do it through reconciliation, which is ridiculous.
Well, what's interesting is Gary Cohn, the guy who didn't get the Fed share nod. Right. Not long ago was advocating for a carbon tax as part of this, and that has gone away. But if they're looking for money, and this would be an interesting time to discuss carbon tax. What I find most interesting is the silence of the deficit hawks. I mean, they were quite vocal. Meadows, the head of the Freedom Caucus, and now they're just kind of going along.
That's because it's not much. It's such a bad tax cut that there's not much of a deficit that results from it. I mean, seriously, $1.5 trillion over 10 years, $150 billion a year. And I understand there's other components to the deficit, but in the context of the kind of money we spend, that's not much. That's an indication that it's a bad tax cut.
If it's true.
And if the
numbers did come down. But, I mean, that's all we heard from the Freedom Caucus and Rand Paul for years, and now they're...
Well, he's not going to
vote
for it.
I think it was their influence that made this such a bad bill.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They kept saying, you can cut taxes, but you can't make anybody pay less money.
I mean, you know... Tax cuts result in less tax revenue. The only way to balance the budget is if you're going to have less tax revenue, you get less government spending. So David Stockman
or greater overall revenue
or greater overall revenue.
Base from which to take the revenue, which is the hope.
But historically,
that's the big question. Yes.
But if you look at Reagan's tax cut and Bush's tax cut, tax revenue goes down when there's a tax decrease, and it goes up when there's a tax increase.
But Aaron, as the economist on the panel, the PhD economist on the panel, it raises an interesting question, which is we're up 3%. I mean, it looks like the economy is growing at 3% right now. That's good for Trump.
That is good for Trump. But he also said that the unemployment rate numbers are phony and that the true unemployment rate is 40%. And now that it's 4.1%, I'm sure he'll be taking a lot of credit for
that. I'm sure you're
right.
Jonathan says, can anyone on the panel speak to whether the new tax plan still includes the same deductions as in previous years for corporations? Pardon me. The new rate will be reduced, but if the same deductions are kept as before, it seems that the relative rate will be minimal. Parenthesis, I do see a minimum levy of 10% on foreign subsidies, and that's from John in Valley Falls.
I would say, and I don't want to, I'm hesitant to answer, but I think it keeps most of the deductions and, in fact, adds some.
Yeah, that's my understanding is that it's smoke and mirrors. You lower the tax rate, but you keep the deductions, so the firms are going to be paying more or less the same low amount, with the exception of that 10% territorial tax.
I suspect they're marginally trying to get to a marginal. That 12.5% rate is 12.5 is where like Scotland
and Ireland.
And I think they're trying to make an argument where they get down to there.
A good friend Colleen answers a question I asked, and we were fooling with, how are charities losers in this? If fewer people are itemizing, there's less incentive to make deductible contributions.
Yeah.
That's interesting, Okay. And George says, are there more examples historically of corporate tax breaks and tax breaks for the rich producing economic growth than the opposite? Aaron?
Historically, no. And I will qualify that with there's a lot of moving parts to a almost $20 trillion economy. So to isolate the effect of tax cuts with everything else that's going on can be difficult. But historically, when you look at it, lower taxes do not necessarily produce higher growth or lower unemployment. There's so many other forces like Federal Reserve policy, trade pacts, and all of those
things.
Compliance
and regulation.
Right. So, it's tough to tell. The New York Times had an article this morning that a lot of economists, both on the right and the left, say the way this tax plan is structured is going to have no effect on growth, but an effect on the deficit.
Greg says, and this is the last letter I have here, Joe, you'll be happy to hear, what happens to people who have high medical expenses? Increasing the standard deduction will not make up for someone who has $30,000 and more in costs due to a serious illness or accident. thrown under the bus, Greg, in Cooperstown.
I think that's true, but isn't there already a significant? I mean, you're to get the medical deduction, you have to reach a pretty high percent. What, 2% or 5% of your?
Yeah.
I mean, so it's already. I think it's already difficult. I always thought there were too many impediments to that deduction in the first place.
Yeah, I myself, I know this is not of interest to any of you, would like to see dental implant and other deductions taken over, because that's enough to make you go get another mortgage.
we just have about a minute before the break. Anybody want to weigh in on Jeff Sessions and the Democrats demanding that he explain his meeting with Papadopoulos, which has come out in recent days because Papadopoulos, you'll remember earlier in the week, it seems so long ago, doesn't it? Earlier in the week was pled guilty to charges, and then in that said that he had a meeting with Jeff Sessions, and then the Democrats said, well, oh, but Jeff Sessions got up and before and testified that we had never had those meetings. So now what?
So this is fascinating. I was thinking about this in the middle of the night when I'm reading this.
No.
And you got a attorney general who is under fire from a president because he has allowed the one way or the other the selection of a special counsel. And now you find that very same attorney general. Do you think, does anybody on this panel think that Sessions himself is at risk for indictment?
I don't know if he's at risk for indictment, but I think he's got a big problem.
He's getting fired as soon as the indictment's in for Mueller.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but he's done.
But I do think he's
I'm gonna go with Judith though when he gets back from the trip.
Yeah,
right?
When he gets back from the trip. I mean, there may be some issues there. I think Congress is rightly very unhappy about the level of truthfulness of the testimony. And I'm probably overthinking this, but if Sessions goes, then the president appoints a new attorney general who will not have to recuse. No, I mean, Rosenstein stays as the deputy. But let's say Session resigns. He says, I just can't take this anymore. I need my dignity. Or he gets fired. The president will nominate someone, you know, maybe like a Rudy Giuliani, who then does not have to recuse on the Russia investigation. And then I think it can get really dicey with Mueller. Again,
No, Mueller doesn't get fired. We're just saying that Mueller would stay in, but they'd still be involved.
What makes you think Mueller doesn't get fired? I think Mueller gets fired, and I think Judith's scenario is correct. Once you put a different attorney general in there and right. you are faced with yourself getting into real trouble, you fire him because you have no choice.
Yeah. Rod Rosenstein, I think, is the best protection for Mueller. I don't think he's going to cut his budget. I don't think he's going to clip his wings. But I mean, it's a good thing for this investigation not to have Jeff Sessions involved.
And what makes you think, Judith, for a single second that this president won't try to get rid of Rosenstein? Okay. I'm sorry, Joe.
Well, I think as they get closer and closer, you know, he might. And this is a time for Congress to say, if you do this, if you fire a Mueller or a Rosenstein, you know, we're going to set up another special prosecutor by statute.
Well, that's interesting because it seems to me there's another question. If you know, I don't think those people in Congress are about to cut their own throats and face primaries, Republican primaries, where it's clear that if they go against this president, they're out.
So, yeah, many of them. I mean, the timing of all of this could not be worse for America.
But it is what, as Andrew Cuomo once says, it is what it is.
All right. We'll hold there. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Ray Graff with news next.
I started out down a dirty road. Started out all alone, and the sun went down as I crossed the hill. And I downed it up, and the world got still. Learning to fly, but I ain't got wings.
right, we got that worked out. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the program. And let me reintroduce the panel real quickly to you. Alan Chartok is here. Judith Eng, Aaron Pasitti, and Rich Onan. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Let us go to other stories making news. And a big climate report coming out today. A giant. And already the science is being questioned, but what should we make of it, Judith Eng?
Well, this is the National Climate Assessment, one of my favorite reports to read. It comes out every 4 years.
900 pages.
Yeah. Congress directed all the scientists, essentially, in the federal government to look at climate change, and it is... It's a really troubling report. It points to more heat waves, more forest fires, more coastal flooding, sea level rise continuing to be a problem, which has huge economic issues. It points out that 2015 was the hottest year on record. This year, we're on track to be the second or third hottest year on record. And this report comes at a time when a majority of people in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands still do not have electricity, do not have clean drinking water. We know that climate change makes hurricanes more intense than they ordinarily would have been. So I think this is very important. Most people won't read it. It'll be interesting to see if there's a move in Congress not to have this report done again in the future. But we are in serious trouble on so many levels. I mean, just look at the last few months, the wildfires out west, the hurricanes in Texas, Florida, the Caribbean. We've got to pay attention. And there's such a disconnect between the science and what Washington is doing.
I was struck by both the governor of Puerto Rico and the mayor of San Juan coming to Washington this week. The governor was on NPR and was interviewed, which I thought was an overly harsh interview. But one of the things that they were pressing him on was the amount, the percentage of people that are without power.
Right.
I believe he was saying 35%. The website says 33%,
right.
And people are saying that it's much lower than that.
Right.
What would be the reason to fudge those numbers?
Well,
especially when you're in Washington and hoping to make the problem better.
Yeah, I think they just don't know. I mean, the utility down there, PREPA, is very incompetent. It's a public monopoly. And there is a debate over how the numbers are presented. I don't think this governor in Puerto Rico, who has so much on his plate, I don't think he's looking to purposefully mislead. What I appreciated from him and also the governor of the Virgin Islands, which is something that I'm working really hard on, which is, and I think I'm going to lose on this one, is when they rebuild the electricity grid. FEMA is planning to spend hundreds of millions of our tax dollars putting the old rickety grid back up, the fossil fuel grid, with no solar to speak of, with no microgrids. And so what's really crucial over the next few weeks is Congress will consider a third hurricane supplemental bill in early December. And I've been working to try to get the Congress to direct FEMA to build the electricity grid differently. Both governors in the Caribbean support that, but will, FEMA has a very firm policy. They just rebuild what was damaged by the storm. So there are very few, wind turbines and solar microgrids in the Caribbean to be rebuilt. They didn't exist before the storm. So I think, if you don't fix the electricity issue, the water issues get worse, the health issues get worse. One reason why a lot of people don't have drinking water in Puerto Rico today is because there's no electricity at the drinking water plant. There's no electricity to run the pump system. So it would be heartbreaking if so much of our federal tax dollars are spent to rebuild what was there before. The people of Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands will be right back where they are after the next storm.
So with that in mind, were you surprised when the president, Trump, made a point that he was going to up the amount of money that the feds were going to put to rebuilding the system to 95%, I believe, was what we read yesterday.
And he called it a total rebuild.
Yeah.
He was looking to do a total rebuild of that power generation grid.
But how do they do it? That's the question. Do they go back to, FEMA is saying they're going to rebuild what was there before. That doesn't make sense.
Well, I think what FEMA was saying, they would build a more modern. First of all, the system was pretty antiquated, the way I understand it. And I thought more than the generation system, the distribution system was a mess.
The power plants in Puerto Rico and U.S. Virgin Islands are all oil-based, and one coal plant in Puerto Rico, very, very little renewables. The plants themselves were not that damaged, but the distribution is a mess. Look, there's no question the system was a mess to begin with, but in Puerto Rico's defense, and I've been very critical of the way they run their electricity system, very few systems could have withstood the hit of two Category 5 hurricanes in 2 weeks. That's a lot to deal with.
What's the justification for FEMA saying we're only going to rebuild what was destroyed? Now, is that just an artifact of time?
No, that's their mandate. The other question, Aaron, is why is this FEMA? Yeah, in other words, why would it be? Shouldn't the real shift be to take this out of FEMA's ambit of authority and put it under, you know, Department of Energy?
Well,
or something like that.
FEMA is the traffic cop,
right?
And they give what's called mission assignments to agencies. Now, your question is a good one. Some people argue that the federal Stafford Act only allows FEMA to act this way. I've looked at the Stafford Act. I'm not convinced of that. However, this is the way FEMA has operated for decades, and they need to change. They're not going to change on their own. So Congress needs to step in and say, as you are rebuilding, you have to build in resiliency, renewables, decentralization, so we're not back here again. And ironically, it's the Caribbean is so vulnerable to the impacts of climate change.
So the climate report comes out today, and so there's your weekend reading.
Thank you.
Very excellent.
Exciting.
Yes.
Maybe I won't read all 900 pages, but certainly the executive summary.
You could get out that highlighter.
Balance it with the tax plan.
There you go. Yeah, right. A good double shot. And then, oh, God. And then Rick Perry. Oh, boy. Okay. So Energy Chief Rick Perry thinks fossil fuels can help prevent sexual assault. So you think, oh, well, he must have. This somehow must be misconstrued. No?
Mm-mm.
Let me...
This is Rick Perry.
Okay. Perry said Thursday that using fossil fuels to power electricity can help villages in Africa and other developing regions. He said during a recent visit to Africa, a young girl told him electricity was important to her because she has to read by the light of a fire with noxious fumes. Speaking at an event sponsored by Axios and NBC News, Perry said electricity also was important, quote, from the standpoint of sexual assault, when the lights are on, when you have light that shines the righteousness, if you will, on those types of acts.
Yeah, I had to read this article a few times, and I wanted to make sure it wasn't in The Onion. I think Rick Perry has distinguished himself as really offering poor analysis on two critically important issues, sexual assault and climate change. I don't know anyone who could have messed up those two topics in one speech, but Rick Perry appears to have done that. It is so unfortunate on so many levels. I think he doesn't understand the seriousness of the sexual assault issue. I would recommend Mr. Perry get trained on the issue of sexual harassment and sexual assault. And we know that on climate change, as the former governor of Texas, which, by the way, is a lot of wind, but he politically really embraces the fossil fuel industry. It was unfortunate comments on his part, and I think they deserve more attention and more discussion.
He says that he calls the environmentalist agenda inaccurate. And a narrative that fossil fuels are harmful because they contribute to climate change. He says fossil fuels such as oil, coal, and natural gas foster economic development and jobs and are an important strategic asset for the United States. And they're looking for U.S. energy dominance in the global market.
And we can do that with renewables, too. I don't know why it has to be fossil fuels. Like, mm-hmm. you can turn the lights on in your house like we do with solar power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't need to be fossil fuel based.
Yeah, it's kind of a false choice. I mean, there's no question that most of our energy production comes from oil, gas, and coal. But there's a moral imperative, and I would argue an economic imperative, to move away from that. And if Rick Perry is so concerned about lighting in areas that don't have electrical generation, well, you know, I'm helping to ship 6,000 solar lanterns to the U.S. Virgin Islands where they don't have have lighting. And solar microgrids are growing all over Africa where homes are not connected to the electrical system. I mean, it was such a profoundly unfortunate series of comments by a cabinet member. You almost don't know where to begin.
A man by the name of... I just lost my screen. Michael Brune, who's executive director of the Sierra Club, said women, and particularly women of color, are among the most severely impacted by the climate crisis, and it is the same communities that are most at risk of sexual assault. Let us move on to other topics, and we'll go to the new Fed chair. We touched on this, and as far as his credentials, but Donald Trump announced Jerome Powell as the new Fed chairman. And I'll go to you, Aaron, of what you make of Mr. Powell.
And Joe, for whatever it's worth, we're getting a ton of mail about Donna Brazile wanting to have some discussion on that.
Good.
So Powell was on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, which is part of the Federal Open Market Committee, who makes the decisions regarding monetary policy. So he's no stranger to the Fed and how it operates. The fact that he doesn't have a PhD in economics doesn't particularly bother me. The Fed's got plenty of PhD economists to advise. Mm-hmm. The bigger concern is that he's another pro-finance person who's come from the investment banking community, and that's probably indicative of his stance on a lot of the post-crisis regulation. So I wouldn't be surprised if you start to see a very slow scale back of, you know, the Federal Reserve supervision of banks. He's already come out saying that banks should be able to increase their leverage ratios. They should be able to borrow more money to meet their capital requirements, which is precisely the issue that led to the failure of Lehman Brothers.
And in fact, Aaron, if you heard his, and we all did, his Rose Garden acceptance speech, he made it clear that the banks were much better off than they were, that they've got a lot more money, that they're much more protected than they were during the Great Meltdown, and it seemed to me that this is all Trump stuff.
Yeah.
Well, wait, is that not true? I thought that most of the major banks had passed their Obama-era stress tests.
And the answer is, I have no idea. And all I know is that banks are in business to make money. They're the ones who got us into trouble the way that they did. And I have no idea whether or not they're playing it fast and loose. If you wanted me to guess at it, I would say, yes, they're playing fast and loose again. And as soon as they can get back to where they were, they will.
But Dodd-Frank did put a fair amount of constraints on what banks can do. And I think that's provided some exceptionally minimal safeguards against excessive risk taking, investing your clients' federally insured money in risky assets. So
and segregating that, yeah.
Right. So, I mean, Dodd-Frank did work. It's a bare-bones form of financial regulation.
Is it in danger? Is Dodd-Frank in danger?
Parts of it are,
yeah.
Sure.
And
yeah.
I think,
well, what Aaron just pointed out, I mean, I think the leverage ratio rules are going to be loosened up. But I think what's not loosened up is the way in which they define the cash upon which you're allowed to use your leverage, right? So in the old days, you have a certain amount of cash, and then you could borrow against that, right? But in the old days, what they called cash wasn't really cash. You could have cash could be your collateral mortgage-backed securities as long as you had a credit default swap insuring them.
Right.
We found out that didn't work. So as long as cash becomes more cash, I think you could have more leeway with the leverage ratio. I know we're getting kind of into the weeds here.
Well, I want to get to the other story, too. So let's talk about Donna Brazile. We have 3 minutes left. Hillary Clinton's campaign gained significant control over the Democratic National Committee's finances and strategy more than a year before the election in exchange for helping a party retire lingering debt from the 2012 presidential campaign, according to a new book by Donna Brazile. The book is called Hacks, the inside story of the break-ins and breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House. Donna Brazile took over as party chairperson in July of 2016 in the wake of hacked emails showing that many DNC staffers were openly rooting for Clinton in the primary. Brazile says that when she took over as interim chair, she set about trying to untangle the financial web that had grown up around the campaign. She says what she learned was that the DNC had made a deal with Clinton's people in August 2015 to clear up the party's debts. She does make the point that this was not a criminal act, but as I saw it, she says it compromised the party's integrity. Brazil's account appears to contradict the DNC's repeated assertions that it wasn't favoring Clinton over Sanders, and it bolsters charges from the Sanders campaign that the primary itself was rigged. And Elizabeth Warren, speaking yesterday, said that she agrees with the notion that the 2016 Democratic nomination was rigged in Clinton's favor.
It's really important that parties not take sides in primaries. And I think there was the concern that perhaps the DNC put their thumb on the scale now in favor of Hillary Clinton. Now, Hillary Clinton did a very good job locking up a lot of early support. She and her husband have quite a network around the country. So she did some early organizing, as she's free to do. I thought Donna Brazile's comments were interesting. She also said in her book that she went around and talked to all the DNC staffers and did not have the impression that anything illegal happened. The DNC seems to always be in massive debt.
But she did sound unethical and immoral.
Yeah. And you know, when a party is in debt, they turn to who they think is a party leader to help bail them out. I think there's a lot here that causes concern and I think needs reform to make sure that in future primaries that no one's putting their thumb on the scale.
Well, she basically said, look, they were broke. Mm-hmm. They were totally dependent on the Clintons for
network.
putting
yeah.
money in. And we're getting mail. We're saying, come on now, Bernie was never even a Democrat, you know, he's an independent, and so why shouldn't this happen? But there are a lot of Bernie people out there, I was one of them, who just really felt that, hey, you got to play it fair.
Well, yeah. Especially and after those emails came out of Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Yeah. Yeah, and the laundering aspect of it. And again, this is all fourth party because you're relying on what Donna said, what she said, somebody else said,
and selling her book,
which I actually may buy. Might be the first Democratic book I've bought in a while. But the whole idea about how money was supposed to go to the state, the state parties, but it ended up kind of looping its way back to the Clinton campaign. I mean, that you wonder from a laundering standpoint, you wonder about that. But yeah, if I was a Bernie fan, I'd be real upset.
Joe, can you get her on the air?
I'm sure you can. And ironically, earlier this week, one of President Trump's pollsters said that he thought if it was President Trump versus Bernie Sanders, that Bernie Sanders would have won. So this is, you know, this is real life.
I think a lot of people thought that, right?
The country was
not early. I mean, remember the beginning when Bernie was so low in the polls, and I love Bernie's positions, but I can't support him because he's not electable.
But once it was clear that Trump was going to claim the Republican nomination, it was clear the country was screaming for a populist candidate.
Yes.
They did not want an insider,
right?
And that the Democrats were just totally deaf on that.
I don't know if that was that clear, though. That didn't really become clear to a lot of people till election night.
Wait,
Alan, you were not surprised by the election? It wasn't until election night that a lot of people said, maybe they did want an outsider.
Oh, I thought there was a very good possibility that and predicted the day before that Trump was going to win. So I know pretty well that there was a populist urge. But after the election, and we saw the election of Trump, we said, okay, if the Democrats had a populist, they might well have won.
Which is why I think Elizabeth Warren, I take her at her word, but when she was asked about it yesterday, she didn't pause and say that she agreed with these concerns. I mean, the real irony, of course, is the Trump voters who thought they were, you know, voting to drain the swamp. I mean, this is the swampiest, most conflicted administration in history. Yeah.
All right, we're out of time. Thanks to everybody for spending your time with us. Rich Honan, when are you coming back? Put you on the spot.
We'll see.
All right, good.
My mom always used to say that when she didn't want to give an answer.
I'll see how much hate mail I have sitting in my email.
It should be relatively light today, I think.
I let Aaron do most of the work today.
Okay. So. Aaron, thank you very much. Judith, always a pleasure. Alan, have a great weekend. Have fun tonight. We'll be back right after this.